Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Thomas Lindsay. He's the executive director and an attorney for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which has assisted close to 200 communities across the country in 8 states to adopt binding laws that elevate community rights to sustainability over corporate rights and power. Well, first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having us back.
So this particular conversation emerged from a non-recorded conversation that you and I were having a while back. And so I'd like to start by reading a couple short paragraphs that you wrote to me in an email that will frame this particular conversation. And what you wrote was, "We should pick up that conversation about law sometime. In many ways, a large part of our work is attempting to use law for what it was never intended to be used for, and using municipal corporations for things that they were never intended to be used for. It's all a great experiment, of course, whether law, which has been historically used as a structure for dominance by a minority, can truly be used for directly the opposite. In many ways, our work as your organization's work today, I presume it's your organization, not everybody's work, is about dissolving the myth that the law serves in the correct capacity today. For example, by attempting to reverse the role of law and forcing the system to crack back, it allows us to illuminate what the law truly serves as a way of leveraging people to a different understanding as part of the building of a movement towards something else." So I think that this is an incredibly important conversation, and I think a lot of people may – there's a lot of information there. Can you start by unpacking what you were saying?
Yeah, I was going to say, now that you read it back, it sounds a little didactic, but I think that's okay. You know, our work, the Legal Defense Fund's work for the past 15 years, has been about helping people begin to think about the system of law that they live under differently. And I think the reason why people don't really frame the problem, you know, when they look outside and the threats to clean air and clean water and the fact that we're blowing this planet up on an almost daily basis, that they tend to try to pin the blame on certain individual actors or certain actions of government or certain things that certain corporations have done. And then they use their resources and time to try to stop those individual decisions instead of understanding that we're in a system or structure of law that's much more comprehensive than just individual decisions that individual actors make and whether those are right or wrong. I think the reason why people don't pin the blame on the system of law and government that we live under is because that system is so camouflaged and in reality is defined by the current system we live in as the epitome of a democracy. So when corporations use certain property rights to overturn communities that want to ban toxic waste incinerators, for example, that people look at that system and the jurists and the law professors and all the important people in the society attempt to explain how that result is logical and how it's legitimate and how it's actually just part of a checks and balances part of the system in which we live. And I think that helps to camouflage everything about how that particular system operates so that people don't – we're so lost at this point that we don't even know what we don't know, because we are on the receiving end of these voices who are the beneficiaries of the way that the system operates, who have cleaned the clocks of our cerebrum, our heads, to try to get us to believe, and most of us have, that the system is operating in our best interest and that it is the way a democracy should operate. And so, you know, for the past 15 years for our work, where we've assisted communities to stop, you know, factory farms and dumping of toxic sludge and fracking and frack injection wells and all the bad stuff that we help communities to stop, on its surface, it looks like we're just assisting communities to say no to those things. But in reality, you know, after, you know, conversations we've had and thinking that we've done over the past decade or so, our primary job is to get people to rethink the system in which they live and to help them understand how it is not in their best interest to allow that system to continue, and that that system has to be disassembled because it bears very little resemblance to any kind of a democratic system that pays heed to self-determination by people and communities to protect themselves from these harms. And I fear, you know, in some ways this all sounds, I think, many times very didactic, because people say, well, you know, Jesus, I have, you know, this pipeline company coming into my community. I don't have time to rethink this whole system of law. I just want to stop this thing. When in reality, stopping that pipeline is connected, of course, to stopping all pipelines, which is connected to the self-determination, the ability of people to self-determine what they want their communities to look like in the next 20, 40, or 60 years, which is, of course, intimately connected on to whether we save or protect this planet of ours and our communities. And so I think it's all part of one huge, large, comprehensive conversation that we've only had several times in the history of this country. But I think it's the place where we're at. It's why the community rights movement stuff, which is the way it's become known, you know, community standing up saying we're not going to do that anymore and taking on the system of law that says yes, you are, that I think it's more revolutionary than people see on the surface, where it's just a saying no to certain projects coming in. That's actually about people re-understanding what the system of government is all about and what it's harnessed to, and how that's a lot different than what their self-interest should be in the community.
So let's back up a second and define some of the terms you're using, because I think you're talking about some really important and also sometimes in some ways complex stuff. Obviously in some ways it's very simple, but in some ways very complex. And so like what – when you talk about this system of law or system of law and governments, what do you mean?
So when we talk to people about the system of government and law that they work, that they exist in. So, for example, communities come to us and say we don't want a hog factory farm in our community. And that necessitates a conversation about why the law doesn't allow them to say no to that factory farm coming in. And a lot of people don't understand that right off the bat, because they think that the United States is about self-government and about democracy, and they say to themselves, why shouldn't our community be able to veto that? Why shouldn't our community be able to pass a one-paragraph law that says no factory farms in this community? But the way the system of law is structured in the United States is that you can't. It's actually illegal and unconstitutional. It violates the Constitution for a community to say no or to veto a big box store or a factory farm or some other use or project that's been proposed for their community. And then the community says to us, well, why is that, right? You're telling us that we can't. You're showing us examples of why we can't, because the examples are all over the landscape. It's settled law in this country that you can't. And they say, why is that? Well, the why comes down to a series of legal doctrines that are embedded in the system itself, that a relatively small number of corporations, a small number of hands in the United States, have manufactured over the past 100 years. And they involve things that most people know about, like preemption, where a state or federal government can actually pass a law that says to communities in a given state or across the United States, you can't pass a law doing this. And the hot area right now, the sexy one, is about oil and gas extraction. So almost every state has an oil and gas act, which actually preempts, nullifies, or overrides any efforts by communities to say no to fracking, or to say no to fossil fuel pipelines, or to say, or even to attempt to regulate certain fracking operations a little bit better than the state might under the regulatory program. So the oil and gas corporations use the state government to put in preemptive mechanisms so that they don't have to worry about communities passing laws that may actually interfere with their ability to extract or put pipelines in or whatever within the communities. It's a cost-saving mechanism for the corporation. So you have preemption as a doctrine, which has been concocted and manufactured by the corporations and a relatively small handful of people over the past 100 years to give birth to this concept that every school child knows that the federal trumps the state and the state trumps the local. Well, how democratic is that is the question, because you're lifting decision-making up to a smaller number of hands further away from where the project or activity is actually taking place. And preemption is just one doctrine. There are four or five out there, like the other sexy thing now, which is corporate rights and corporate personhood, that corporations have certain rights that they can sue your community. If your community says no to a pipeline, a corporation can come in and say, you're violating the corporation's constitutional rights. and then they can sue the community to overturn what the community wants to pass. And so when we say system of law, what we're talking about is a system of law that has, in effect, been commandeered by a small handful of people over the past 100 years to make it work in a certain direction. And as Richard Grossman, who was my predecessor in some ways at the Legal Defense Fund, my mentor, he was a historian, says that the system is constructed for the endless production of more stuff, the endless production of more everything. And because of that, that begins to control how the governmental system operates, that the governmental system has to put into place certain legal doctrines, which it has, to protect that endless production of more stuff and to insulate it from self-determination. So people in communities can't interfere with that endless production of more stuff. And as we move further and further into the 2000s, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Global Trade Agreement and NAFTA and GATT and the way the Commerce Clause in the United States has been used to mow down communities who have a different vision of a future other than one filled with pipelines and frack wells and everything else, that we are becoming more and more corporatized because there's nothing to stop those legal doctrines from being expanded now. The people's resistance to them in a structural sense have all been taken out. And so there's very little standing between the corporate boys and actually the final bricks in what we refer to as the corporate state, in which the entire governmental system is harnessed for certain beneficiaries, those beneficiaries being the corporations and the small handful that controls them.
So everything you said is really rich, and I have like five different directions I want to go. So I'm going to throw out a few of them, and we can go whichever way you want to go. One of them is, I don't remember which book this is, probably all of them, that I wrote that in many ways economic production is the god of this culture. It is the thing which must never be questioned. And it's always extraordinary to me that, you know, with the health of the planet at stake, with the life of the planet at stake, that production is once again still the thing that can never be questioned. There's a great line by somebody or another, Coombs was his name, unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture. And the degree to which this belief in economic production and growth, I mean, for God's sake, the world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized at a greater value than the entire value of their catch. And that's just nuts. You know, there's so many, and we could produce a bazillion examples of that. So that's one thing. The next thing is toxic mimics are something that I've written about some, which is a toxic mimic is something that takes the form and perverts the content of the other. And it's a great way to parasitize off of a wonderful or important thing. A classic example one example would be that rape is a toxic mimic of sex, that some of the same physical actions occur, but it's a complete toxic mimic and that the emotional content is completely different. And we can come up with a bazillion examples, but one of the ones I'm thinking of right now is I was doing a talk, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, about law. And my main point was that, or one of my main points was that laws are made primarily by and for the rich. And, you know, it's basically rules made by rich people to benefit rich people or powerful people, however you want to say it. And, well, first off, do you generally agree with that definition?
I do, to describe the system that we're currently in. I think one of the interesting things about the United States, or what became the United States, was that this enormously helpful vision was laid out by the American independence movement, which temporarily was able to secure what I find to be a extraordinarily different understanding of who government should serve. And unfortunately, that vision of the American independence movement was quickly smothered and then replaced by the U.S. constitutional structure, which is the epitome of a centralized structure of law that can be harnessed for exactly what you just mentioned, which was, you know, the rich and the powerful using the law to benefit the rich and the powerful. So I think there are some instances in the past that have opened a window but have not been able to hold that window. And I think because of the planet's status and, you know, what you talked about in terms of the end of things as we know in the name of economic production, I think we might be back to that same, we need to crack the window again.
Well, so, okay, where I was going to go with that is that one of the ways that this horrible use of law and governance is able to maintain some credibility, I think, is because it's a toxic mimic of well, I'm saying this very poorly. I was doing this talk years ago where I went on and on about how law is made primarily by and for the rich, and we need to really understand that. And then I had one throwaway comment, which I think is very important, which is I also said, I'm not saying that there's nothing wrong with laws against rape. And for that, I got pilloried by anarchists because, of course, there can be no laws. But the point really is that I think it seems to me that laws and enforcers of laws, whatever they may be, serve two important functions. One function is to try to protect grandma from a meth addict. You know, we need people who are weak in some way need to be protected from those who would predate upon them. And at the same time, it's like Christian Parenti said to me years ago that most of what cops do is, you know, walk down the street and, you know, stop a burglary or something. But the most important thing they do is crack strikers' heads. And so there's two functions. One is some sort of maintenance of a social order. I mean that in a good sense. And the other is social repression and enforcing the laws of the powerful. So do you agree with that, that there's these two functions?
No, absolutely. And I think that the predominant function is to be on hand to bust the heads of the strikers. In other words, it's almost akin to me, you know, people talk about the interstate highway system, how great it was for mobility, but they forget the interstate highway system was essentially built for tanks to be able to get from coast to coast because we were afraid of an invasion. And so it's like all the good things, I mean, putting aside the fact that interstate highways are not really good at all, but all the good things that we have in the culture by accident. It's like somebody once said that radiation was truly the product of nuclear power plants. It wasn't electricity. Electricity is just the extra thing you get, but radiation is actually the product. And so I think I'm in agreement with the fact that all the good stuff, a lot of the good stuff that we have is an accident, that it was actually intended for other purposes. And we tend to believe that the accidents are the main purpose, but they're not.
And I would agree with that. I might also say what Lewis Mumford said about how a really good, by which he doesn't mean positive, I don't mean positive, but a really smart, whatever, authoritarian system is not going to crack heads except when it has to. That the main way it works is what Mumford calls a magnificent bribe, which is you give people an interstate highway system. You give them the internet. You give them this stuff, internet, which of course is primarily used A, by the military, and B, for
commerce. Yeah.
So I agree with you, and I would say that one of the added benefits of this is the bribe that will help us buy into the system so they don't have to crack our heads.
Absolutely.
And so having Go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say I agree with that. Our culture tends to, again, emphasize, it tends to see the collateral as the product itself and to glorify it as the result of our democratic participation. And, you know, even it reminds me also of the story in Kentucky, where Kentucky activists organized under Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, which is a statewide group in Kentucky, to actually ban strip mining. They wanted to completely ban all strip mining in the state. And what happened next was the big environmental groups came in and said, well, you're not being practical or reasonable about banning strip mining. So they talked Jimmy Carter into signing a law that regulated strip mining, which actually allowed it to happen as long as the companies had a permit. And so what we remember now is we hold out and glorify that regulation as saying somehow that that was the main goal. But in reality, you had people with much more radical goals who were immediately sidelined by the obedient factions who decided that regulation was the best that they could get and so sold out the real stuff. And we don't remember the real stuff. We just remember the regulation. Then we glorify the regulation, and that becomes the entire universe for us.
So would you agree with Catherine McKinnon's line about how, what is it, law organizes power?
I think it goes both ways. I mean, it's almost like the culture and the law. You know, the law punishes those who act outside the culture, and the culture itself gives birth to the law. It's like a self-reinforcing mechanism between the two.
So that was a predecessor question to my next one, which is actually your question, which is it possible, I mean, since those in power create the laws to serve those in power primarily, and I'm leaving aside like laws against rape, laws against murder, which we can put the same thing with laws against murder, for example, that I've long felt that Tony Hayward should have been put on trial for murder and presumably executed for killing the humans in the Gulf of Mexico and killing the Gulf of Mexico. And it's like a joke I've told for years, which is not very funny, is what do you get when you cross two riddles? What do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, earliest release date, 2036. And the other one is, what do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. That's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide. So having said all this, I want to come back to the question in your note at first, which is it possible, given that structure, and maybe given that structure is the thing we need to deconstruct, given that structure, is it possible for realistically for law to then, once again, I'm not talking about, you know, laws against sexually assaulting children. I'm talking about economic law here. Is it possible to use law to actually stop the destruction? I want to tell one more story first, which is, you know, I was doing a lot of forest activism in the 1990s, and we activists all over the country were able to shut down a lot of the Forest Service timber sales by making them follow the law. Clean Water Act, NEPA, NFMA, Endangered Species Act, all that stuff. Because the timber sales were violating law. So we were able to say, you have to follow the law, and then they would put out a slicker document. You know this story 100 times. You know, they'd put out a slicker document. We'd stop them again, stop them again, stop them again. Finally, what they did is they just passed a law called the Salvage Rider that basically said, we can put out any timber sales we want, and tough luck for you. They're no longer susceptible to environmental regulation, which told all the activists, as soon as you find a way to use the law to stop them, they change the law. So having said all that, is it possible? You asked me this question 3 months ago, and I'm just punting and giving it back to you. Is it possible to use law, to use the system of law to stop destructive activities then in a larger scale?
Yeah. I mean, that's the million-dollar question, because if it's not, then we're always on the defensive. We're always in a dissenting position. We're always reacting to someone else. And we validate a structure that divests us of actually being able to use the law proactively to build economic and environmental sustainability. And if we're always on the defensive, then this place is without armed rebellion. I mean, without something much sharper than just the organizing as we know it, even the defiant organizing, which is being done by communities now across the U.S. and trying to stop certain corporate projects, that we're screwed. And if that's not acceptable, then we have to actually envision the time, a new time, that law can be harnessed as a vehicle for sustainability rather than being harnessed as a vehicle for the endless production of more stuff. And I think at different times in the past, it has been. Some of those has-beens have been very temporary. So, for example, after the Civil War and the abolitionists drove in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, it was only less than a decade in which the corporations began using the 14th Amendment for themselves. So even
that's
through
the best
blood,
toxic
you know.
Mimic. I mentioned toxic mimics. That's a great example. I should have used that one. The corporate personhood is a great toxic mimic. Anyway, sorry, go
ahead. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so the question is, how do we make it stick? And what's fascinating to me, I'm kind of a student of the American Revolution and what it was and what it wasn't, because it's glorified quite a bit in modern day literature for things that it wasn't. But what they attempted to do in this amazing period of time, basically 15 years in this nation's history, is that they attempted to build a permanent revolution into the governing documents for this country. They essentially said that the European system of government was the rich using government to afford the rich's interests, and that it had nothing to do with self-determination and nothing to do with natural law and nothing to do with government protecting people's rights. And they turned that on its head, not because they sat down one week and said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we turned European systems of law on their heads, but because they had to. They had to garner enough support to actually put the warm bodies in place to win the American Revolution before any of it would become a reality. And so they drafted, at least on paper, this expansive view of government, which had government as the servant of people and the lawmaking process as the servant of people, so that people were the source of all governing authority and that governments were only legitimate as long as they recognized majorities able to populate and control those governments, and governments that operated to secure people's rights. And that if governments didn't operate that way, that people had the right to abolish them, to alter or abolish them. It's the language in the Declaration of Independence. And so they attempted to construct an entirely different system of government than what the European understanding of government was, and to harness the system of law and lawmaking to a much different purpose than was understood and stitched into the fabric of European governments and their understanding of what governments were. And again, that experiment lasted from 1776 to 1789. And it's also not to glorify the U.S. during that period, of course, because whereas all the white people were talking about freedom and liberty and self-determination, we had over 4 million African Americans who were enslaved as property in the United States. So when these folks were talking about self-determination, they were talking about self-determination for whitey. They weren't talking about anybody else, women, African Americans, indentured servants. But having said that, the system of law that they conceived, if it was broadly applied to everyone, that was a fundamental different understanding of government. And it lasted barely 13 years, because the same centralized folks who were in favor of the revolution to get rid of Great Britain because Great Britain was interfering with their own commercial interests then rose up in the United States and put in place a centralized system of government via the U.S. Constitution, which essentially opened the door for corporations to claim certain constitutional rights and privileges and for communities to be subordinated to that system of federal constitutional law. And so the question that you ask is multifaceted, because it's not only, number one, can we envision a way that a system of government could work that is actually does something other than merely advance the interests of the rich and the powerful to use the law to enhance their position, but can we hold it? And those are two different things. And I think that the only thing strong enough probably to force that change is survival. And we are now faced with the question of our very own survival. We're faced with a system that is rapidly driving us towards creating a lifeless orb of this planet. And I think that's the only thing powerful enough to actually force the law to serve a different interest. And whether that's possible or not, we don't know. It's a conversation that you and I had on the phone a month ago, which was, is that possible? We don't know. But we know what happens if you don't. And that is that the system left unchecked and unchallenged and unreplaced will continue to march down the path and strip away everything that everybody that we care about and eventually renders it into this inert thing. And while it does that, all the law professors and the judges and all the important people, the politicians, are going to stand around and say, yep, this is all a democratic outcome, that we're rendering the planet inert, this is a functioning of democracy, and oh, it's such a bad thing, and maybe we should write more letters to Congress, but all in all, it's a good thing for people. And we have to cut through that crap, and we have to build a different vision, because if we don't, they're more than willing to run this thing into the ground, which is what they're doing.
Yeah, and this is not going to surprise you, because we've had this conversation before, and it's not going to surprise anybody who's read my books, but I think that the desire to maintain control is going to continue by those in power. Is going to continue to outweigh survival. I don't think they will act in their own interest, even of their own self-survival. But there's actually another direction I want to go with this, which maybe is the same direction, which is 1997 or so, I was at this conference or big workshop of maybe 20, 30 people. And toward the end of it, they said they want to do this visioning experience or something, exercise, where they said, okay, pretend it's 20 years from now and we've achieved some sort of sustainable community. And by the way, it's 20 years later and we have, of course, haven't. But we have some – I want to know what this community smells like, what it feels like, what it tastes like. And everybody was giving these answers of, you know, people, you know, walking through just idyllic situations. And when they got to me, of course – I basically had to just let out an explosive fart, you know? I said, well, this bothers me for two reasons. One of them is that how do we get there from here? I think it's really important to have this vision of what it looks like, but at the same time, right now, you know, you have George Orwell's statement that if you want to picture the future, picture a boot stamping on a human face forever. They're not going to give this up because we designed something. And I said, second, let's say we in our communities do have this wonderful, idyllic, beautiful situation, this wonderful, sustainable community, and then all of a sudden those in power discover dilithium crystals under our land. We know what's going to happen to our community, and we know what's going to happen to us. You know, it's like, so how do we deal with – this is why I asked the Catherine MacKinnon question is how do we as human beings who love – the planet and who love community self-determination and love community, there's a line by Huntington, I believe his name is, which is that the West won the world not by the power of its ideas, but by its ability to apply organized violence.
Yeah, very much so.
And so how do we I mean, I think part of my work, people sometimes, you know, they accuse me of being the violence guy, but it's like, no, what I'm trying to do is get you to actually look at the world the way it really is, look at the culture the way it is, and then we can make some decisions. So if you and I believe, I think you and I agree on many, many, many things. It's like it goes back to what you said in your note, you know, what are we trying to do? What phase in this revolutionary consciousness that you and I are talking about, however we mean revolutionary, where are we at and what do we need to do?
Wow. I mean, you know, we're at the very beginning of the beginning. It's almost like, you know, I'm writing a piece now on the American Revolution. It took 12 years. I mean, 12 years of repeated British oppressions for even a small band of people within the colonies to begin calling for American independence. You know, 12 years of the Stamp Act and the Tea Tax and the Boston Massacre and British soldiers shooting colonists. And even after Lexington and Concord, when the first real shots were fired, that people were still apologists for Great Britain and for a system of law that was literally, at that point, killing them. And so I don't think we can underestimate the amount of abuse that people will take before they begin to pry open a different history and a different understanding of the system that has delivered a certain structure to them in the immediate sense. And so building that critical mass right now, we almost call it a pre-movement, that there's not really a movement yet for community rights or a movement for sustainability. It's almost a pre-movement right now where the groundwork is being laid for a relatively small number of people a la the abolitionists in the 1850s, who essentially numbered, 20 people coming out of Ted Weld's tutelage and folks coming out of Cincinnati, Ohio, that the abolitionist band was very small. The American Independence band was extremely small in the 1770s. But right now that band is forming, and they're being forged in these fires of community resistance to state and federal control that's being engineered and manipulated by the corporations who are the beneficiaries of that control. And that small band is now figuring out what that system of law needs to look like for this planet to be protected and for the communities to be protected. What is that new system of law? What are some of the components of that new system of law? And instead of just sitting around in sewing circles talking about it and endless speeches about what we have today with these environmental groups and labor groups talking about how nice it would be if we lived in a different kind of world, but then not really taking any direct action to confront the system that is and build a new one, is that these people, these small bands, are now gathering in their own communities and they're hijacking their municipal corporations. So their towns, villages, counties, cities, they're actually taking those structures, those municipalities, which are in essence under the law municipal corporations controlled by the state, whose job is to carry out state policy on this endless production of more, essentially. And they're hijacking those municipal corporations. They're hotwiring them, as one of our organizers likes to say. And they're starting the car without keys. And they're attempting to use those vehicles to directly confront this system of law, which is mostly being used by the corporations trying to force a pipeline in or whatever the other project is that's coming into the community. And so they're putting it on the line. They're putting it on the ground, which is they're taking this new system of law. They're actually codifying it into ordinances and laws. They're hijacking the municipal corporation to actually build that system. They're being the change that they think needs to take place. And instead of just laying it out in flowery language, they're actually writing it into law. They're seizing the law at the municipal level. And they're daring the corporate boys to dislodge them. They're saying, we're here, we're building this new system, we're not waiting for people at the federal level to somehow slap their foreheads and begin building a different system themselves. We're doing it in our communities, and we're doing it now, and we're daring you to dislodge us with an understanding that when the corporation comes to dislodge them, that it illuminates for more and more people what is actually happening and what is the structure of law that's empowering the corporation over the community itself. It's our hope that repeated confrontations, thousands of those confrontations across the United States, and probably tens of thousands of lawsuits, which is the way that the corporations attempt to dislodge that new vision that's taking place at the community level, that with each confrontation, with each spark, with each of those conflicts between the communities and the corporations, that more and more people will begin to grapple with what the system of law actually looks like and begin to frame the problem not as Corporation X being a bad actor, or Corporation Y putting in a pipeline that they should be putting in, but it's just Corporation Y's problem, that the problem is something broader than that. It's actually the system and structure itself, and begin thinking about how they change that system out, replace it with something different. And I think that, when I have hope these days, that's it. I mean, it's three or four people in a community who are coming to different conclusions about what the history of this country is and how violent the history of this country is and how violent it continues to be because the system has censored our very brains. It has defined things within the grooves of our brains, and we have to reject that. We have to throw it off and actually build a different kind of culture that gives birth to a different kind of law.
And I think, as is so often happens with various forms of autocratic empire, autocratic governing systems, those in power are oftentimes, they provide us the ammunition we need by their responses to our attempts to bring some sanity and local sanity, sustainability, and democracy to the situation by overreacting or by not being as flexible as a smarter dictator might be.
If the organizing is done correctly, And I think that is something that we failed miserably at over the past 50 years, which is the organizing itself, if it defines the problem as the pipeline and the possibility of a pipeline exploding and safety issues around the pipeline, defeats the entire organizing model. Because then the corporation can come in and shield the pipeline or assure people that the regulatory process is acting overtime and everything's fine, that it defines the problem as the pipeline itself. It doesn't define the problem as the corporation having more rights and powers than the communities in which the corporation is doing business. And so I think the difference between the organizing that we're seeing today at the community rights level and the organizing that's been going on for the past 50 or 60 years on environmental labor fronts is that it is defining the problem in a different way. So when people in, you know, to be less abstract about this, so people in the Broadview Heights, Ohio, pass a law that says no fracking in Broadview Heights, they're also passing parts of that same law which say corporations don't have constitutional rights, and that federal and state governments can't preempt Broadview Heights. You know, what good are those in the sense of the current system of law? Well, they're invalid, right? And that's what people, oh, you can't pass those, they're invalid. Well, if we actually don't frame it by using the codified law at the local level that way, then you don't draw the right challenge from the corporation. So when the corporation comes in to take you apart, and they can just focus on pipeline safety or whatever else, rather than focusing on the structural dynamics of what makes this whole place tick. And so by doing the organizing in a very sophisticated way to blueprint how the conflict occurs between the corporation and the community, if that's done correctly, you're not only organizing that community in which you're in, but you're also setting up a model to illuminate and decamouflage those rights and powers held by those other levels of government as well as by the corporation. And you're setting the stage for a framing of the problem that then gives birth to a very comprehensive solution, which instead of just requiring double-hauled tankers, for example, actually begins to go about the business of removing rights and powers from anybody else other than the community itself that has the right to self-determine. And I think that's the crux of the matter, is that our organizing sucks. You know, whether it's writing letters about the Trans-Pacific Partnership or trying to get stuff disclosed properly, it's all crap. It's all about trying to make the existing system operate slightly better rather than envisioning a different system. And it would be okay if we could make it slightly better and actually solve what's happening, but we can't. We actually need a new system to replace it with.
Well, this is one of the things that I've loved about your work. We were talking about this not long ago. How long have we known each other? Since 1990?
Yeah, I think it's been 15, 20 years. Long
no,
time.
It's 25 years.
25 years, yeah.
Good God, we were young.
We were.
Anyway, I think part of the conversation you and I have been having for 25 years is that, for me, the distinction, I actually, once again, I sometimes get pegged as the violence guy, but I don't like that because it's not accurate. And I'm really the let's put everything on the table guy, and I don't have a problem. In fact, I think you might be, I might have less problem with a lot of reform work than you do, but which I think is kind of funny, really. But the thing is, I don't really care what one does to try to stop a destructive project as long as one is honest about the need for structural change. And for me, this is one of the reasons I can't stand what my friend calls gangrene, the big environmental organizations, is that the question for me always boils down to, who is your loyalty to? To whom do you have your loyalty? Is it to the system, or is it to the willows and redwood trees and streams and creeks? And we can also talk about local governance, local community, local human community, local non-human community. And as soon as, for me, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that says to me is to break our loyalty to the system and not try to work to make the system work, but instead make our loyalty to the frogs, newts, whomever it is our loyalty is really going to end up being to. And then once you do that, it seems to me almost everything is tactical or strategic, and you can make strategic mistakes, you can make tactical mistakes, but if your goal is to protect, here's what I'm trying to say, if your goal is to protect the system, it doesn't really matter how good your strategy or tactics are, because you're going to end up protecting the system. And if your goal is to protect the real world, then yes, you can make mistakes, but at least your baseline is you're trying to protect the real world.
Maybe. I think that there are some qualifications on that as well, which is the fact that while we go about saving, you know, a population of tadpoles in a certain water body, that the energy and resources that we're using for that means that we can't use it on the ridgeline that's a mile away to save it from being clear cut, because there's a finite amount of resources and time that people have to devote to those types of activities. And so at some point, when we do the individual actions, which I would agree are very important, the problem is that for the last 40 years, our focus has been on those individual actions alone, which eat up the resources and time and everything else that we have, and that, not enough to the structural change.
That's why I said that you have, there's a sentence I put in there that I may not have emphasized enough, which is, if you're doing whatever individual action, you're also making the larger structural critique a part of it. I'm making clear why you're doing this.
Yes, although that's tough to do, because groups get stuck in that regulatory hamster wheel, which automatically requires you to begin making arguments that are preset by the regulatory framework, which, of course, the regulations were written by the very corporations that ostensibly they're supposed to be regulating. And so it actually changes your behavior when you engage in those individual acts of trying to stop a specific thing here or there. And so I'm of a mixed mind. It's to say, over the past 15 years, we've used permit appeals and those types of things quite a bit, but mostly to delay so that we can get the real stuff into place, that is the structural change stuff. And so I'm of a real mixed mind on the individual regulatory actions where groups arise, they grab at whatever tools they have, and then they begin doing that work, because that system itself is so all-encompassing that the group generally is relegated back to becoming a fundraiser for the lawyer that they've hired, who now determines what the strategy is going to be working within the regulatory system, and we lose them. We never see those communities again. And so it's a real push-pull between those two things. But I'm in agreement that whatever we do, unless the structural piece is there, the structural analysis about why things have to be different structurally, and it's a structural problem. Without that, the individual actions are meaningless, and I think we have to come to that point. It doesn't help that the existing large environmental groups are all geared towards, you know, 100% of the time doing those individual response stuff, working within the regulatory and established legal systems.
So I'm sorry to do this to you, but the phone's ringing. I have to get it. Hold on for just a second.
Sure.
Hello? I know. I'm finishing an interview. I'll be down in a minute. Okay, bye. Sorry about that.
Okay.
And that was my mom. There's an emergency down there. Not a scary emergency, but emergency. So sorry to give this to all the people on the radio, but we basically had like 2 minutes left anyway. So can you... I mean, I guess I want to say one more thing before we move on to the last thing, whatever that is, which is that the point I was really trying to emphasize is the importance of decolonizing and breaking your loyalty to the system, because that's a problem I have with – I keep thinking about something that John Osborne has said a million times, which is that a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground and end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Because if you start asking, why is this – corporation allowed to destroy this piece of land, and then you start asking, why does the economy destroy land? Is anybody allowed to destroy any land? And the questions keep going out and out and out. And it seems
to
me,
I think that happens.
That's the problem, and that's the question. That's the question I've been asking about so many mainstream environmentalists for years, and that's why I don't consider mainstream environmentalists environmentalists, because their loyalty is still to the system. But it comes back to, I think that your work also is one of those tools, or your work provides tools to people to help start asking those questions that can then lead them to asking the larger questions, and ultimately then to acting against the destructive system. Is that part of what you're trying to do?
I think so. I mean, when we talk about decolonizing, that's a very important piece, but decolonizing without action is also worthless. I mean,
oh.
I'm being very blunt there, but the fact is it's got to be coupled. The action has to be commensurate with the decolonization that people are going through. Otherwise, the decolonization has no purpose to it. And so I think in many ways, and I know we're at the end here, but the key is when we talk about self-determination, we loosely, you know, use the phrase community self-determination, that it's not just talking about self-determination of the people within the community, although that's very important that, you know, majorities of people should be able to make certain decisions and make them stick in their community. But we're also talking about the non-human community as a community. So a river, a stream, a ridge, a forest, that those ecosystems and species and population of the species must have rights of their own under the system to self-determine. So a river should have the right to self-determine its course, and in some ways its flow, and other attributes that we may normally not think about in terms of self-determination. But I think in the end, when we use the phrase community self-determination, it's not just the self-determination of the people in the community, but also carving out that space in the law and actually enabling those ecosystems to be protected by the law as they self-determine themselves.
You know, really what we're talking about is a struggle that has been going on for at least 6 to 10,000 years, which is a struggle between those who believe that a struggle for a way of life that's based essentially on slavery versus a way of life that is based on community self-determination, including the non-human community. This is, you are, I think, holding hands with a whole long line of people, whether they are the suffragists or the abolitionists or indigenous rights activists, and people going all the way back to those Humbaba who opposed Gilgamesh. I think that so I want to thank you for your part in that long and incredibly important and life affirming struggle.
Yes, thank you for being in that same place as well.
Well, thank you for listening. My guest today has been Thomas Lindsay. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.